Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Sudeman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Psyched to have a Happy New Year. Happy New Year to everyone out there listening.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends on New Year's Eve. Yeah. Right? That's what
something
this is?
Something like that. I don't know what day it is. Time, when you have kids and it's the period in between Christmas and New Year's, the time has no meaning. So no idea what day it is.
I read that comic book. It was great.
Or what day it's going to be going up.
First up in controversies. The Zack Snyder adaptation of that comic book was not so great.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, Peter, thank you for derailing this whole thing before we even got started, is Netflix. We're talking Netflix because there's a big piece in N Plus One magazine by Will Tavlin. I assume I'm pronouncing his last name right. With the subtitle, the title is Casual Viewing. Subtitle is Why Netflix Looks Like That. And it's a long, sprawling piece. I would say there's not a ton that is, strictly speaking, new in it. I don't think there's a ton of stuff here that we haven't either seen or discussed before on the show, but it's nice to have it all in one place. And it's a very long, sprawling piece about the origins of Netflix and how they kind of lied about their, you know, oh, I had Apollo, I had a movie out from Blockbuster for multiple weeks and I got a $40 late fee. And I was like, what is this? This is nonsense. We're going to do it better at Netflix. Nonsense story. That's not true at all. But you know, the broad strokes again have kind of been covered in other places. Netflix gets its start as a DVD by mail company. It shifts to a tech company. In the process of shifting to a tech company, it essentially tries to mimic and then does better and bigger than the cable model, introduces binge watching, creates a series of, shall we say, in-house stylistic guides and ticks that, you know, are essentially designed to allow people to watch casual, encourage casual watching, the sort of watching you do while you're folding your laundry. I like to call these shows laundry folding shows because that's basically what they are. They're shows you can watch and not really pay that much attention to because the characters are always saying what they're doing, and they're recapping what they've done throughout the movie for you, so you're not really ever lost. It's very convenient. It's very convenient. And then, you know, of course, they had the patina of, you know, really classy, artiste-driven fare, and of course, that has also gone by the wayside because they realize that that's not really where the money is, right? The most interesting thing, and again, I think I kind of knew this already, but the most interesting thing that this piece highlighted for me is the ways in which Netflix really tries to appeal to the vanity of the people who are involved with making their movies. There's a segment in this story where the author talks about going to look at the billboards, that Netflix has erected to prove to people that it's out there advertising their movies. Look, we got, you know, or not just Netflix, of course, Amazon Prime does this as well. I think the specific movie that they referenced, that Will references, is a film called Burial or Buried. It's the Tommy Lee Jones movie about a funeral home that it doesn't matter. It's barely a movie. This movie. It doesn't exist in any real way, except that it's on the internet somewhere. But they put up billboards for it. Prime Video put up billboards for it, proving, look, there's a Tommy Lee Jones, Jamie Foxx movie. It exists. It's real. We're out there marketing it to people. And of course, they don't do that. All of these services use their homepage as their main marketing element, right? And that is that has a lot of different repercussions, the biggest of them being, and this is kind of the main point of the piece, there is no idea of success and failure in the world of Netflix. And of course, Netflix says, well, we know it works. We have all the metrics. We know what we want more of. We know what we should get and blah, blah, blah. We don't overpay for things. We do it right. We're optimized, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess maybe they do. Sure. Whatever they're doing certainly seems to be working, given the massive amount of revenue that they're generating. But Peter, the real question is, what business is Netflix actually in, right? Is Netflix in the business of making good movies? Because I think the answer there is pretty clearly no. Is it in the business of making good TV shows? Again, I think the answer there is probably no, though you can make a better case for their TV division than their film division. Or is it just to be background noise for people to waste their lives away watching?
So, Sonny, I'm going to reply to you right now. And just for anybody who's folding laundry right at home, like, just I'm replying to Sonny. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to praise this piece first. And then I'm going to argue with it a little bit and try to say that it, in some ways it undermines its own very interesting premise. Because the premise of this piece is fundamentally that Netflix has solved the William Goldman problem, right? And so William Goldman is the screenwriter who in Adventures in the Screen Trade, I'm going to be slightly, the early 1980s book where he sort of famously said, in Hollywood, no one knows anything. And the thing that no one knows is what audiences will like. This has always been a problem for the studios because you have to spend a lot of money to make anything, and sometimes people don't like it. So you spend a lot of money and some of the things don't work at all. And what Netflix has figured out how to do is solve that problem by making nothing need to be a success, right? And then what this piece does is it turns and argues that the way that Netflix has solved this problem is by devaluing the signal that box office returns provide. Big grosses, right, at the box office, they tell us what audiences like. Box office revenues tell us what is a success and also serve as artistic guides and they help launch careers of artists and they help establish genres, things like that. And so one sub argument of the piece is try to think of a filmmaker whose career Netflix has launched, not a big filmmaker who came to Netflix, but someone who was launched by making a movie on Netflix. It's admittedly pretty difficult to do. So Netflix is not doing that, right? And so there's a flip side to this. If the market, if the box office is providing the signal for what audiences like, then Netflix's success is also providing a signal for what audiences like. And this is, I think, the kind of the weakness of this piece, which, to be clear, I think this is a really excellent essay. It's really readable. It's really it's smart. It's just really nicely structured. But what this piece is arguing is that by devaluing box office, they have devalued movies and artistry and all of that. And I think part of what the implication, though, is most audiences, or at least a lot of viewers, don't care about that. And it's clear that because that Netflix is, what Netflix's success tells us is that all is that the artistry, the vision of a young upstart filmmakers isn't actually all that relevant to many, maybe even most viewers. And think about the paragraph in which this essay gets its title from, Casual Viewing. In that paragraph, the author writes, look, that there's a zillion tags that Netflix uses for its content, but one offers a suitable name for this kind of dreck, casual viewing. And this is a quote, usually reserved for breezy network sitcoms, reality television, and nature documentaries. The category describes much of Netflix's film catalog, movies that go down best when you're not paying attention. Okay, but what is the author referring back to? A huge amount of what used to get made before Netflix. And so in some sense, what Netflix is doing is just providing the thing that audiences, especially audiences at home, have wanted forever. Crappy sitcoms, reality television, nature documentaries, stuff that just isn't very challenging and can be watched while you're folding laundry. Yes, it's true, but this isn't new to Netflix. And this, I think, is the biggest weakness to this for this piece, which is, yes, it has a great historical sweep, but it doesn't quite ignore this. I don't want to say that the author just like refuses to acknowledge this, but it tries to kind of gloss over and step over the fact that this is a lot of what the cable networks and the big broadcast networks offered for decades, long before HBO pioneered premium television, long before Netflix existed. And in so many ways, this is not a Netflix problem. This is not something that Reed Hastings invented. This is simply the fact that many viewers want Like, the thing that they want demonstrably is something that isn't challenging, something where the characters are kind of constantly telling you exactly what they're doing. You don't really have to pay attention. It doesn't matter. Go back and look at 90s, at anything that is, any scripted show from the 80s or 1990s. Yes, there were some greats for sure, but so many of those shows were designed so that you didn't really have to pay attention. That's why executives at the big networks were skeptical of heavily serialized shows for such a long time, is because if you didn't tune into the first episode, then you wouldn't understand the second episode or the third or the fourth. They wanted things that were just sort of easy to go down. You could turn it on and sort of not paid that much attention. You could watch it while eating pizza and, managing your kids or your new puppy or whatever. And again, I think this is a very good essay, and it really kind of captures a lot of the arguments and discussions that we have had about the streaming era and its foibles and pitfalls on this podcast. But I also think that it positions Netflix as some new and unique version of this. And it's unique in the sense that it has a different delivery technology, sure, and that it has operationalized some of this stuff a little bit more and a little bit differently thanks to some new technology. But I don't think it has invented, it didn't invent casual viewing. Casual viewing has been around for decades and in fact has been the mainstay of television in particular.
Sure, sure. Though, Peter, certainly you have to agree that the scale, solely the scale of Netflix, the amount of money it was throwing around, which was based largely on accumulating debt and working off of its insane early valuation, warped the entire economic sphere of. I mean, it was like a black hole, right? It bent the entire wave of entertainment light around it in ways that I think we're still kind of grappling with.
I agree to some extent, but so did Marvel. So, to a lesser extent, did Star Wars, even when it came out. So has basically any big success. Yes, Netflix did so in a somewhat bigger way, simply because of the sheer volume of cash involved. And at the same time, I don't feel like Netflix is doing something fundamentally new. Netflix is taking an old idea, which is that people want stuff they don't have to care about that much, and doing it at a scale that is somewhat novel, but even there, I don't know if the scale is all that novel just in terms of viewership, given that part of this piece's argument is viewership is actually lower than people think. And go back to the 1970s and the era of the three big broadcast networks when they were at their peak. Like, the big broadcast networks were reaching huge, huge numbers of people in something like the way that Netflix is.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alyssa, that is kind of the point here. Again, we come back to this idea of Netflix as not really a replacement for cable, but more a replacement for ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And I want to go back to, Peter's paraphrase of William Goldman, nobody knows anything. Because I think the truth is often that audiences don't entirely know what they want either, right? I mean, they know what is sort of, blandly, consistently satisfying on a repeat basis, but they don't know what they're going to be surprised by. And some of the, just most delightful and entertaining moments in American mass culture have come when something new burst on the screen, on the scene, and was incredibly popular that, sort of pulled people together, right? I mean, I think if you go back and read, if you think back to the sort of, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, like the 70s era of cinema, a lot of that was new in tone and style, and in even sort of what you could say in mainstream cinema, and people really responded to that. Explosion onto the scene and cultural dominance of something like Star Wars. People don't know what new things they're going to like until someone shows it to them. And what I found sort of profoundly dispiriting about this piece was just the way that it sort of pulls together the extent to which Netflix is kind of determined not to create those kinds of cultural moments, right? I mean, I have talked on this podcast countless times about my, you know, the belief I have developed over time that the invention of the binging model was actually kind of socially malign, in the sense that it just meant that there was never a sustained cultural conversation about any of these things. And also that, you know, Netflix's sort of patent stat cooking around viewership numbers meant that it was attempting to sort of manufacture the appearance of pop culture consensus in a way that was just obviously not grounded in reality. But, you know, I think the thing that I found most dispiriting reading this piece was, I think it was Ted Hope saying, or, you know, some of the indie filmmakers saying, like, you know, our movies, financially, it was good to be able to sell these movies to Netflix, but these movies just never had a chance of being found, right? They were not going to be advertised. They were not going to be in theaters, and they weren't going to be fed to anybody by the algorithm. And, you know, Netflix has done what is obviously outstanding for its business model at the expense of giving the impression that it, you know, is totally uninterested in sort of surprise and delight that it is, you know, the company as portrayed in this article and, you know, and I think a lot of other things we've read and talked about, you know, does not appear to be, you know, interested in using its cultural dominance to introduce people to things that they might like, right? It is, you know, the algorithm is inimical to those moments of sort of alchemical surprise when something new bursts on the screen, right? I mean, I think if you had told all of us when we were kids that like an adaptation of Game of Thrones was going to be like just like a cultural big deal for a decade, all of us have been like, I mean, we're nerds. That sounds great. I don't believe this at all, right? And like that moment of sort of cultural, you know, surprise and consolidation and conversation was, you know, the thing that defined my, you know, full, the period of my career that was devoted full time to covering pop culture. And, you know, I miss that sense of surprise, right? It's, there are just not a lot of people who have the guts to do the new thing and put it out to people and be like, you know what? I think you're really going to like this.
Can I ask how you guys think, Alyssa, Sunny, like if that's where you're going to go with this, like there's no surprise and no novelty, how does Emilia Perez fit into that? Because the movie that we watched and reviewed last week is, we had mixed feelings, mixed to negative feelings, I would say, in this group. No one was particularly taken with it, but that movie was bonkers. That was crazy. That was definitely not an algorithmically determined piece of like flaccid crap.
Sure. But I guess the question is, like, who was that getting fed to, right? Like, was there a concerted effort to, like, make sure a bunch of people tried that for 2 minutes, right? And I just don't know because I don't have a perspective inside Netflix's black box. I mean, certainly the reason I sort of pointed to that line about independent filmmakers saying, like, well, financially this was great, but, like, culturally it was just deadening because this stuff kind of disappeared into the maw, right? I mean, you know, it's one thing for Netflix to buy Emilia Perez. It's another thing for Netflix to make like a real concerted effort to be like, we want to persuade you to look up from your laundry and watch this.
So I agree at least 31%.
Netflix, it should be pointed out, did not make Emilia Perez. They acquired Emilia Perez. Yeah. This is, you know, and this is...
Sure, but they're spending their money on it and putting it on their platform.
Yeah, but also, like, it's certainly not the sort of thing that they would have just made because, like, or maybe they would have. Maybe they would have, frankly, and it would have disappeared into the ether like everything else that they do. This is the key point of the film, the indie film experience when it comes to Netflix, right? As Alyssa said, they buy things and they put them on the platform and then they disappear into the platform because the platform does not serve the needs of the indie filmmaker at all.
I agree to a great extent, but I just want to say that over the last 15 years, let's go back to roughly, basically to the dawn of the MCU, things, indie films, interesting auteurist projects, non-superhero movies and non-sequels of all types. This, forget Netflix. Look at the world outside of Netflix. It, like, anybody who is trying to do something that doesn't fit into that mold of we're going to make a $200 million sequel has struggled. It's not that there have been no breakouts, but there have been just huge struggles for everyone. And that's not just a Netflix or just a streaming problem.
Right. But where I do think the difference lies is that if you are a, you know, a theatrical distributor and you buy a movie, you have a strong interest, like you have an, you know, fiduciary obligation by the nature of your business model to go out and try and sell that movie to people, right? Like to say, this is something that you should want to watch. And Netflix, by nature of its model, has no such obligation. And, you know, as far as I can tell, like no such interest in breaking people out of their algorithmic tranche or nudging people from one tranche to another, right? And there's a difference between, like, I mean, I just think the models have radically different incentives, you know, like just feeding, you know, movies into like the maw of the sandworm that is Netflix. Unlike on Arrakis, is not guaranteed to produce spice. Like there are no, to torture that metaphor.
And the other thing here again is the overwhelming nature of the amount of money that Netflix has warps the whole market here, right? Their overspending on indie films cripples all the other, even studio-backed indie outlets, right? Like, to the extent that the other studios are overpaying, possibly for lesser stuff, which in turn then doesn't get watched because people are like, well, why do I want to go see this? I don't know anything about it. Like, my concern with Netflix, as much as anything else, is just the amount of money they're throwing around. It seems like it's destabilizing the whole industry in very negative ways. You could argue the same way that the Marvel and Disney and Star Wars are destabilizing things. Fine, that's like if you want to make that comparison point, that's fine. But I think the way Netflix has picked up movies like Hitman. And stuff, other stuff that could have been, you know, like a solid double in movie theaters. Not a home run. That's not the sort of movie that's going to gross $300 million, but it's the sort of movie that could gross $70 or $80 million, right? And then have a healthy run on VOD and then on streaming. And instead, it's in theaters, it's in like 20 theaters for 2 weeks, and then it's on Netflix, and like nobody ever mentions Hitman again.
It seems to me like the thing that is most destabilizing in the industry right now is actually the pullback in streaming spending, not the amount of it. And one way to think about your complaint is that you're complaining that someone is spending too much money on filmmaking creatives. Like all that money goes to, yeah, the producers, maybe you don't care about them, but it goes to the screenwriters, it goes to the actors, it goes to the below the line talent. And the more of that there is, then the more stuff gets made.
But at the expense of totally destroying an industry model that created long-term sustainable jobs in all of these industries.
Yeah, I mean, like we say, like, oh, well, the pullback now is what's bad. Well, the only reason it's bad is because it's the only game in town. Like, that's why it's bad. It's bad because they killed the rest of the industry. They killed the other economic part of the industry. They undercut it at every turn, and now they're like, well, we're not going to spend as much money on it, so...
Is running long, but I will just say, like, it's not at all clear to me that theatrical is mostly killed by Netflix versus mostly killed by a pandemic that shut most movie theaters down for a year or so, or at least a huge number of a large majority of them, and kept people out of movie theaters globally for about a year. And then a series of strikes that shut down production for 6 months or so, a couple of years after that. And
yeah, but that don't you think that accelerated a trend that was already underway, where the big studios were trying to collapse their, you know, own business models into a single line of revenue, driven largely by the success of Netflix?
So I don't know if I don't actually think I totally agree with what you just said. What I think is what was happening before then is that big studios were trying to move everything into surefire, a small number of surefire, very large bets. But they were doing so successfully and were drawing people to movie theaters. And the thing is that, like, box office just hasn't recovered from the pandemic. And the closures of the pandemic that started the huge decline here. And then that was exacerbated by the fact that people were scared about returning for years. Like, we came back after we started going to movies for a year afterwards, and I would bet many of our listeners did too. But for that whole first year that things were open again, starting in early 2021, lots of people just weren't going. And then you had 6 months or so of no production, which has meant that this year there are just far fewer films in theaters and finished. And like 2019 was a banner year for the box office. Maybe the movies weren't good. Maybe it was, maybe you can complain that, like, yeah, it was all just Avengers Endgame. But people went to the movie, to movie theaters, and studios successfully brought them there. And that was during the time that Netflix was running up the tab on spending money on screenwriters and directors and filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're kind of talking past each other in terms of the, you know, the overall box office versus, again, the extent of the impact on one specific segment of it. But yeah, we're going long, so we're going to have to, we'll just say the existence of Netflix is a controversy. All right.
We're all going to agree. Okay.
All right.
No, that's fair.
Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for a bonus episode on life in the 1960s as seen in the world of film. And now on to the main event, a movie that is set in the 1960s. Imagine that. See how that works? A Complete Unknown. So A Complete Unknown is the story of Bob Dylan's early years, from his entrance onto the folk scene to the moment he went electric and caused riots. People so mad about him playing an electric guitar. Dylan is played by Timothy Chalamet in this movie. He comes to New York City. He hitchhikes into New York City from the wilds of Minnesota before he wows Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie with his original folksy bedside song to Woody Guthrie. And they're like, hey, you should come be in the folk scene. And he comes in the folk scene, and he meets Joan Baez, and he's hanging out with Sylvia Russo, who's based on a real person. I can't remember her real name. She spends most of the movie being kind of confused about him, and they're on again and off again dating. But I feel like that's kind of the mode for everybody in this movie with their relationship to Bob Dylan. They're kind of confused about him and what he wants and what his actual artistic impulses are. And he, as his fame explodes and as those impulses, you know, kind of trend him toward going electric, which, again, big no-no on the folk scene. The 1965 Newport Folk Festival, very controversial moment in music history. And as he's, like, racking up interesting acquaintances, there's this great kind of running friendship with Johnny Cash, who's played by Boyd Holbrook in this film, as kind of like, I saw somebody describe him. He was playing Johnny Cash like he's Jim Carrey. I was like, oh, that's actually about right. That's about how he is playing him. You know, the subdued Jim Carrey, not the wacky Dumb and Dumber Jim Carrey. I'll just lay my cards on the table. I enjoyed this movie because it works as a musical biopic is supposed to work, right? It introduces us to famous singers, and then it has them sing the famous songs, right? That's all people want from a musical biopic. That's all they want. They go to Bohemian Rhapsody. They want to see Freddie Mercury singing Queen's hits, right? They go to the Bob Marley movie that came out a couple years. They just want to hear Bob Marley singing Bob Marley songs, right? You go to A Complete Unknown, and you just want to hear Bob Dylan singing Blowing in the Wind and Like a Rolling Stone, right? That's what people want. That's all they want. That's all they want from a movie like this. I think Chalamet's fine. He's entered this very annoying, for me personally, phase of his career where I have to acknowledge that he's good in things. I resent that. I really resent that because I have never cared for Timothée Chalamet. I think he's always annoyed me. But between this and Dune Part 2, and even to a lesser extent that Wonka movie he was in, I'm like, I got it. More than that, and this is extraneous to the film, his publicity work for this movie has been outstanding. I got to give it to the guy. He's got like whatever spark modern young stars have been missing to like kind of hit that next level of movie stardom where people are like, I like him and want to like hang out with him. He finally has it. He's got it. He's perfected it.
Can you give one example quickly? Because I have no idea what you're talking about in terms of the marketing.
Just like all the videos I see of him doing interviews with like these fucking TikTok people, or like he was on College Game Day. He was very charming and like giving great and interesting and smart predictions somehow. People were blown away because he was like actually giving smart college football predictions. He's very good. He's very good at this sort of thing. So anyway, I had very low expectations for this movie and it surpassed them easily. So I mostly had a fine time at the movie. Alyssa, what did you make of A Complete Unknown?
So for listeners who cannot watch this episode, on video, which is unfortunate, Peter, was miming shooting himself in the head during Sunny's description of what a musical biopic should be, and then nearly became hysterical. It's incredibly amusing. Before I answer that question, do you guys have a favorite Bob Dylan album or like phase?
No.
Yeah, like everything before about 1971.
I like his popular songs. I like a Rolling Stone and Hurricane.
Yeah, I just totally tuned out after like he started really changing personas like every few years. And I should say I totally tuned out as in I went through my own like mini light Dylan phase not very long ago, within the last 5 or 8 years.
Well, I am a Blood on the Tracks girl myself, which is sort of outside the purview of this movie and this podcast. I liked this. I don't know that I loved it, but I liked it in part because I think James Mangold, who we haven't even sort of talked about the direction of this movie at all. I think James Mangold does something that a movie with a different subject would have been sort of mandatory, which is to explain the subject, right? And Bob Dylan is kind of not explicable. And the, you know, like Joan Baez and Sylvia Rousseau are sort of the audience, and Pete Seeger, even to a certain extent, are the audience surrogates in being very sort of drawn to this person, but just not understanding him in a fundamental way. And in fact, you know, the plot is driven kind of by a series of misunderstandings. And Dylan is someone who is not willing to explain himself, in fact, in many ways, sort of actively averse to explaining himself. Like, you know, he shows up in New York and is going by an assumed name. And I really do adore the Dylan biopic, I'm Not There, which has seven different great actors playing Dylan's different personas in what's essentially a collection of short story vignettes. In I'm Not There, the Dylan played by Cate Blanchett at the Newport Folk Festival, like that Dylan and his band shoot the audience with machine guns, right? It's like very different, very experimental. But both movies have in common a sort of reluctance to psychologize Dylan that I think serves them well. And, you know, I think part of what is interesting about this movie is an argument both that cruelty can be incredibly important in artistic innovation, and that great art sort of defies being constrained by politics, right? It is, you know, the crucial moment in the movie is Pete Seeger saying, you know, can you just hold on a little bit longer because your presence in this artistic movement is crucial to something political. We're sort of almost there. Can you please just hold on for a little longer and get us there? And Dylan refuses to make that compromise, right? I mean, he does to a certain extent by going electric, produce that kind of moment of surprise that I was talking about in the cons and non segment, where, you know, he has this audience at the Newport Folk Festival. And, you know, to be clear, Dylan himself had released, you know, like he had released electric music beforehand. You know, it was not like a surprise that he was experimenting with electric guitar or electric bass, etc. But, you know, he converts the rioters, right? He, you know, he starts out by giving them something that they think they hate, and then they discover that they love it. And so I do think the movie's kind of, you know, resistance to some of the pieties that have kind of dominated discussions about art for the last decade are really interesting and well done, not sort of overly underlined. But, you know, Dylan is a kind of artistic and political opportunist, and that being kind of the key to his greatness is kind of an interestingly uneasy message for a movie that does so many of the conventional parts of a biopic well to have as its core message. And I found that really intriguing and well done.
Yeah, I don't know. I am by no means a Dylanologist. As I say, I don't have strong feelings about his music, but I have always found him kind of interesting as a political figure, because he has always at least seemed to me to be very hesitant to being pinned down in any one specific way, and in a way that has allowed both fans, like, it has allowed him to be championed by different groups of fans at different times as, like, one of them, right? Like, he's a very interesting, the way I think I described him as a shapeshifter or a trickster god in my review. And, like, that is kind of how I feel about him in general. He is not, and that's how he comes across in the movie. There's a scene where he is asked to perform at a fundraiser, and he's like, I want to be the opposite of whatever these people want me to be. And that is a very, as a natural born contrarian, that is a very, I understand that impulse a lot. I get that. Peter, you hated this movie.
This movie is casual viewing for the Academy. Like, it's very well made, it's nicely acted. And I just didn't feel like it had any insight at all. Its insight is Bob Dylan's hard to know. That's a sentence. It's not a 2 hours and 20 minutes of movie. And what it does is it treats Bob Dylan, and especially the early Bob Dylan, like a kind of superhero IP. And this is the prequel that we are finally getting, where we are seeing the moment where he writes this song and where he gets into a relationship with that famous girl. And like, it's like, oh, I know that. Right? Oh, like, and I say this as somebody who is not a huge Bob Dylan fan. I went through a light, brief Bob Dylan phase in my late 30s. I've continued to listen to some of his earlier records. I have a bunch of them on vinyl. They sound good, but I just didn't feel like I learned anything about Bob Dylan from this movie. And yes, in some ways, that's the point. I get that he is an enigma, and you can't pin him down in some way. But there's no moment in which you see Bob Dylan on screen and can imagine the person off screen. And this is the argument I often make about written characters, about fictional characters. Can you imagine them doing something normal that isn't part of this movie or part of this novel or whatever? Can you imagine them in their private life? This movie gives us no way to imagine Bob Dylan outside of these little vignettes of the public Bob Dylan that have heard about, maybe not all of them, but certainly most of these moments before.
Peter, I think you've made a fundamental mistake about this movie.
Quite possibly.
Bob Dylan is not the main character of this movie.
Yes, which is weird for a Bob Dylan biopic.
But so my husband's theory of this movie is that it makes much more sense if you think, and he loved this movie. His like sort of joking theory, and which he has given me permission to appropriate here, is that Bob Dylan is in this movie as Donald Trump, right? He is
what?
The sort of out. Yes, he is the like sort of outsider figure who is taken in and kind of co-opted by this movement, who thinks that they can use him to you know, sort of ride their way to
stop
success.
Nukes in Vietnam or whatever.
But then he runs off with their audience and they're like, he's like Pete's, I mean, his theory is basically that like Pete Seeger is Paul Ryan or like, I mean, more, and I told him more accurately, like Pete Seeger is Rupert Murdoch because they, Seeger and Dylan ended up like reconciling at a memorial for Woody Guthrie in 1968. But like, this is a movie, like the people who don't understand Bob Dylan and think that they have sort of some theory of him are the main characters. Like Bob Dylan is not actually the main character. It is a movie that is not about sort of the, like, it in fact rejects the sort of superhero IP, right? Like we never go back to Minnesota. We never learn like what the sort of primal, you know, trauma, we like it deliberately avoids that. And in fact, it is a movie that is primarily about being left behind by Bob Dylan and about sort of misapprehending a lot of ideas about art, about a political movement and a political moment and what it was going to become. It is about the state of unknowingness and about misapprehension. And Bob Dylan is the vehicle for a lot of that. But I don't know that he is actually the most important character in the movie in a way. Like, I think in a weird way, the main character of the movie is Pete Seeger.
Interesting. I think that that's an interesting read on the movie. I would put it slightly different in the same frame, though, which is that he is basically like Heath Ledger's Joker from The Dark Knight, right? Which, like, very famously in that movie, the Joker just comes up with different origin stories as the movie goes along. And the point is, it doesn't actually matter where he came from. What matters is his impact on the here and now. And that is very much the point of this movie, I think, which is that, you know, Dylan himself says, like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where I'm actually from. It doesn't matter what's real. None of this is real. There doesn't make any difference. Just listen to the songs. The songs are what matter. And this,
I agree.
This is, Peter.
And if that's your argument, then go listen to the songs.
The movie is. But Peter, this is what you were like rolling your eyes and wanted to yell when I said that the whole point of the movie is he plays the songs people like. That's literally the movie. You said, I wrote it down because it cracked me up. Bob Dylan is hard to know. That's a sentence. It's not a 2-hour, 20-minute movie. You're right. The 2-hour, 20-minute movie is him playing the songs. It's him that's listening to the music. That's the only reason this movie exists and why it has succeeded and will continue to play for the rest of awards season is because you know what people like to hear? People like to go to the movies and they like to hear songs that they already know. They just want to hear. They want to hear Timothy Chalamet
like
singing,
I said,
"Blowing
it's
in the Wind" with Monica Barbara
for the Academy.
I mean, I guess this is what the whole genre is. This is what the whole genre is. I like it works. It's formulaic. You can make a movie like Walk Hard making fun of it. But, like, it works because people like it, and it works.
It ain't me, babe.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on A Complete Unknown? Alyssa?
Thumbs up. I liked it.
Peter?
It's a weirdly well-made movie for being not a very good movie. Thumbs down.
Thumbs up. He sang the songs that I wanted to hear, so it's a good movie.
Buy the records! Buy the records and 2 half-decent speakers and listen to the songs!
Or I could just go to a movie theater and watch him sing the songs on better speakers. Think about that.
They're not bad.
All right, that's it
speakers.
For today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.